Then, finally, a miracle happened.
But after a year or two of eating pickles, the people who lived in Pickleopolis got plain sick of eating pickles.
We love stories!
It's time for the apple seed, filled with stories for you and your family, all kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. I'm Sam Payne. It's such a pleasure for me to be with you and to be with you every time as you tune in to bring these stories into your home and into your heart. Tales today from Bob Reiser, Bill Harley, Liz Weir, and Dolores Hydock, all fantastic storytellers who will bring their tales to life. And because we know that the sharing of personal and family stories can sometimes be the spark that ignites a memory that you can share with the people that you love, I'll share a memory of mine, all about how I came to be comfortable in a new home. And because great stories get into our hearts and minds in so many different ways, we'll have a conversation with our friend Stuart Foster about a podcast dedicated to the study of games. The study of games is called Ludology. That's all coming up this hour. We're going to begin with a story from Bob Reiser. This is a Japanese folk tale. And in this story, Isunboshi, a young boy in Japan from a loving family, goes through life with an interesting dilemma, a dilemma for which he was named. What is it, you might ask? Well, that's for Bob Reiser to tell. Here's Isunboshi from Bob Reiser on the Appleseed.
Long ago on the island of Japan, there lived a farmer and his wife. They were wonderful, generous people. But they had one problem. They had no children. And day after day, they would pray to have a child, any child. And then finally, a miracle happened. They did have a child, a baby boy. He was beautiful. He had a little round face and little round eyes and pink cheeks. There was only one problem. He was only 1 inch tall. Well, that's just about the size of your thumb. But they loved this child. They loved him so much that they gave him a special name. They called him Isunboshi, which means 1 inch man. And they raised him with the best teachers and the best food that they could give him and gave him the best clothing and the best upbringing. And by the time Isunboshi was 16 years old, he was smarter, he was stronger, he was wiser, but he wasn't any bigger. Still, one day, he stood on top of the table so he could have a man-to-man talk with his father.
Papa! I know I don't look it, but I am nearly a full-grown man. And I think I would like to leave the farm and go out into the world to seek my fortune. Well, the farmer was very upset because the world was a very big and dangerous place and anything could happen to a little 1-inch boy. But on the other hand, would it have been fair for him to make little Isunboshi stay there for his whole life? No. And so he gave Isun his permission. And he gave Isunboshi a special present. He gave him a little pin to use as a sword to protect himself. And he gave him a chopstick to use as a walking stick. And his mother gave him a walnut shell to put over his head to protect him from the rain. And the next day, little Isunboshi set off to seek his fortune. His mother and his father waved goodbye. Goodbye, Isun. Goodbye. He waved goodbye. Goodbye, Mama. Goodbye, Papa. And off he walked with his walnut shell
his chopstick, and his little pin sword. He walked, and 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 he walked, until he finally came to a river. This was the biggest river he had ever seen, and since he was so little, the river looked even wider. But when he looked way, way across, he could see the towers of the city. This was where he was going to go to seek his fortune. But how could he get across this big, wide river? And then he had an idea. He took the walnut shell off of his head. He set it in the water. He sat down in the walnut shell. It was a perfect fit. He took his chopstick and he used it as an oar, and he began to row across that river. Up and down went the waves of the river, and since he was so small, those waves seemed very, very big. Up and down and up and down, and still on he rowed and rowed and rowed. His arms were getting exhausted, and the waves were higher and higher, and he rowed on and on. Do you think he was scared? Oh, yes. But he was very brave. And finally, just as the sun was beginning to get low in the sky, he got to the other side. He shook the water off the walnut shell. He put it back on his head. He shook the water off the chopstick, and he looked around. There was the city. People were rushing by him, going this way and that way, walking as fast as they could. They weren't even looking where they were stepping, and Ethan realized this was not a safe place for a one-inch man. He'd better go to a less crowded part of town. So he walked, and he walked, and he walked, and he walked, and he walked, until he came to a part of town where the houses were big and far apart. And up on a hill, he saw it. The biggest house he had ever seen in his life. It had towers on it, and it had flags waving from the towers. It was a castle. He walked up to the huge front door, and he took his chopstick, and he knocked. Click, click, click. And the big door opened. And standing there was the biggest man he had ever seen in his life. The man had a big crown on his head. It was the king. Who's there? Who's there? He shouted. Looked around. He didn't see anyone. Who's there?
Your Highness?
King looked down. And then he saw a little one-inch man with a walnut shell on his head. And he picked him up into the air and looked at him. A one-inch man. That's the cutest thing I ever saw in my life.
I'm not cute.
Yeah, well, you're kind of nervy. Well, what can I do for you, little one-inch man?
Your Highness, I have come here to seek my fortune. I would like a job at the palace. I would like to be a palace guard.
The king looked at him.
A one-inch palace guard? Well, you got a lot of nerve. All right. If you want that, you've got it. You've got the job of being special guard to my daughter, the princess, and you can help her with her homework.
And that night, the people at the palace had a special uniform made for a one-inch palace guard. And the next day, Ethan Boshi stood there in the princess's chamber, right on top of her desk, helping her with her homework. His arms were folded. He stood with his legs far apart,
Very official. A real palace guard.
Well, all of the ladies in waiting, they looked over at the princess and they giggled. Did you see that? The princess has a 1-inch guard.
The princess was not amused. She glared at her ladies-in-waiting.
Well, if you could see him the way I see him, you wouldn't laugh.
Well, the next day,
Issanboshi and the princess and her ladies-in-waiting went out on a picnic into the woods behind the palace.
They walked along, Issanboshi in front, looking for trouble. The ladies-in-waiting next, carrying the picnic baskets, and in the back, the princess, looking beautiful. As they got deeper and deeper into the forest,
suddenly, from behind a bush, there leaped a horrible demon. Oh, this was an ugly, ugly demon. He had great big purple elbows. He had orange hair. He had huge hands, almost the size of a window. And he had long, horrible gray fingernails because he never, never trimmed them. I'm going to take the princess and I'm going to steal her and sell her for all the money I can get. And nobody's going to stop me. But Issanboshi jumped in front of the demon. I'll stop you. The demon reached down to grab Issanboshi, you little lunnage man. And Issanboshi pulled out that little pin sword and he stuck the demon right in his big fat thumb. Ow! 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 That hurts! That hurts! That's smart! Oh, look, it's bleeding! What'd you do that for? What'd you do that for? And the demon ran off into the woods.
Well, they walked on a little bit further. And then, out from another bush, leaped another demon, more horrible, more disgusting, more dirty than the first one. This one had great big knees that looked like watermelons. And he had great, great big feet that squished when he walked. And his feet smelled horrible because he never changed his socks.
I'm going to steal the princess and nobody's going to stop me.
Issanboshi jumped in front and he pulled up his little sword. I'll stop you.
Yeah, yeah, you'll stop me, I bet.
And that great, big, horrible demon picked up his enormous stinky foot and tried to step on Issanboshi. Issanboshi took that sword and he stuck it right into the demon's big toe. Ow! 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 And he hopped off into the woods.
Well, they walked on a little bit further. Then out from a bush jumped the most horrible, ugliest demon of all. He had an enormous head, about the size of 10 pumpkins. He had a giant mouth with great big slobbery gray teeth because he never washed them. And he had a long, long, disgusting tongue that dragged on the ground.
I'm going to steal the princess, and nobody's going to stop me.
Well, Issanboshi jumped in front. I'll stop you! And the demon, without a word, grabbed Issanboshi and popped him in his mouth. They stared. All the ladies in waiting, the princess, everyone stared. And then suddenly, the demon's mouth opened. Ow! 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 And there was Isanboshi inside the demon's mouth, sticking that long, slobbery tongue with that pinned sword of his. Ow! Ow! Get out of my mouth! Get out of my mouth! I'll give you any wish you want! Get out of my mouth! And with that, Isanboshi jumped out of the demon's mouth. The demon stood there crying. What do you have to do that for? This is my mouth. I'm hurt. Okay. I promise you a wish. What do you want? Isanboshi looked up at the demon. I give my wish to the princess. The princess stared at Isanboshi. She stared up at the demon. And she said, I wish the whole world could see Isanboshi the way I see him. And there was a great big puff! And suddenly, Isanboshi was standing in front of them, a 6-foot-tall palace guard. Well, all of the ladies started to giggle. Ooh, he's very handsome, isn't he? Ooh. Well, soon after that, the princess and Isanboshi got married. And his mother and father came to live at the palace. And after that, many years, the princess and Isanboshi became king and queen. And they ruled wisely and well. And the people of the kingdom lived happily ever after.
Isanboshi, the story of the One-Inch Man, told for you by Bob Reiser. And in just a moment, we're going to bring you an entry in the Radio Family Journal about a way that I found to be comfortable in a new home far away from home. And you're going to hear a conversation with our friend Stuart Foster about a podcast dedicated to ludology, the study of games. That and stories from Bill Harley, Liz Weir, and Dolores Hydock all coming up. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. Bob Reiser before the break, Bill Harley, Liz Weir, and Dolores Hydock coming up in just a bit. But first, an entry in the Radio Family Journal in which I figure out a way to feel at home even in a home far away from home.
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family, right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
It seems like it's always the way of things, that when you move to a new place, you find yourself a little bit at loose ends until you find something to grab onto that makes you feel at home in your new home. And sometimes the thing you find can take you by surprise. I learned this, or began to, when I left home for college. It was my first time living away from home, and I sort of flailed around for a minute trying to find something that made me feel at home in my new home. What I found were a couple of terrific hikes that were easy to get to from my dorm room. I also found a Godfather's Pizza about a block away, and some friends to go and hang out there with. Problem solved. I had it figured out, and I felt at home. As it turns out, though, that was just a test run for a bigger challenge. After my first year of college, I moved to Argentina. It was for sure the farthest from home I'd ever been. And just as it happened when I went to college, I flailed around for something that made me feel at home in my new home. Oddly, the first thing I found was a zoo in the city where I lived. When I was a kid, we used to go to the zoo all the time. I loved the zoo, and here in faraway Argentina, there was a similar zoo. So that helped. But what really made the difference was soccer. In every home, in every town in Argentina,
lives a soccer fan. Football, they call it, of course. But it's absolutely ubiquitous. All the kids spent all the hours they weren't in school on the soccer field. All their fathers came home from work each night, changed into their soccer shorts, and gathered in vacant lots and dusty fields to play until the sun went down. Churches built soccer fields adjacent to their buildings and gathered on them often. The church I attended had just such a soccer field. When I lived back home, I was hardly a soccer player. I wasn't even much of an athlete. I had played baseball for a couple of years on little league teams, where I did okay, but didn't particularly distinguish myself, and I had learned to love running when I was a teenager, though there again, I wasn't a first-place finisher. I just liked to be out there on the road, moving along. What I was, really, was a reader. Other kids my age had favorite basketball players. I had favorite books. I loved The Princess Bride, for example, with its funny, tender, thrilling story and its exotic denizens like the Turkish giant and the Sicilian villain and the Spanish swordsman out for revenge. Maybe I satisfied whatever athletic longings I might have had through the strength of the giant Fezzik or the skill and discipline of Inigo the swordsman. In any case, everyone around me in my new Argentina home, and I mean everyone, was playing soccer, and they invited me to join them. And so out onto the field I went. And at first, I was a little timid. It probably wasn't embarrassing to be on the field with me, but I was for sure no star. No big asset, even. For sure, I felt even more like a fish out of water in a new and strange place. It stayed that way for about half a game. Somewhere in the middle of the second half of the first soccer game I played in Argentina, on the church soccer field, I found myself muttering under my breath something you may find a little ridiculous. If you'd been standing really close to me, you'd have heard me say, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." I have no idea why that even came into my head. But the next time I charged the ball, I did it with a little more confidence than the last time. Again, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." And now I'm like an actual presence on the field. Somehow this mantra is kind of working. I keep it under my breath, of course. I'm not interested in the other players thinking I'm bonkers. But over the course of the game, I must mutter those words 100 times. And I do okay. I score a goal. I block some important movement for the other team. I make some key passes that result in good things. To be sure, my mantra doesn't for a second endow me with greater skill on the field, only with a modicum of confidence that didn't at first come with me into the game. And it's enough, that confidence. It's enough to make me begin to fall in love with soccer. And it lasts pretty much the whole time I lived in Argentina. I've been in 100 situations since then where I've had to get used to something new, a new place, a new skill, a new tool, a new job, new friends. And I know it's a little bonkers, but sometimes in those situations, if you're really close to me, you might just find me muttering, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." It's often the first step toward finding myself at home in a new home.
The Radio Family Journal of Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining me for that entry of the Radio Family Journal. We always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love. Have you ever had to make yourself at home in a home far away from home? Well, maybe those are memories and thoughts that you can share. Coming up, we've got stories from Bill Harley, Liz Weir, and Dolores Hoddock. But first, how about a conversation with a friend? Great stories come into our lives in so many ways through the things that we tell each other around the kitchen table or the living room or the campfire, to the great songs that we digest and love, to the food that we share with the people around us, and of course, through radio and podcasts. And introducing us to some of his favorite podcasts, we have Stuart Foster, one of our assistant producers, and shall we say podcast junkie? Shall we say that?
Yeah, we'll say that my podcast feed is always full, Sam. It is always, there's never not an episode. episode.
That sounds like a new way of saying my cup runneth over. Podcast feed is always
with
full.
Podcasts.
And we're going to hear about a favorite today. Tell us about Ludology.
Yeah. So this is a podcast that really focuses in on, well, play and gaming. That's what Ludology is. It's the study of play. And what they particularly focus on is board gaming. And so it's the podcast itself, as it turns out, is very, very family friendly, simply because I know a lot of families board game together. And this is like something that people love to hear about. They love to hear where their board game came from. Why it got designed, you know, where everything from the old stuff like Monopoly or, you know, Jenga to much more modern things like Catan and like, you know, your big Euro games and such. I'm a huge gamer, so I'm a huge fan of this.
You know, we have a, I have a son who, ever since he was a little kid, it's been his family job. Whenever the family gets a new game, he goes and wrestles the instructions to the ground and then comes and teaches us all how to play it. But there are people who, that's been kind of adopted out into the, like, people will call him and say, hey, we got this new game. Can you learn how to play it and come teach us?
Okay. Sev, you don't even know how much I identify with that. Because, so in my family, I'm known as the instruction reader.
There you go.
Simply because that's what I love reading board game instruction manuals. I know it's so weird. I'm so glad that it doesn't seem as weird to you because you know somebody.
Yeah, we got one of those.
Nice. So yeah, this the episode that I was bringing to you today, though, is called Rock'em Sock'em Robots. It's a part of a series of episodes that they do called Biography of a Board Game. So if you're looking in their feed, you'll find a bunch of different types of episodes. One of those is Biography of a Board Game, and that kind of... it will, like, highlight or spotlight a single board game.
Right.
And in this case, it spotlights
Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
I know. Did you ever play that?
Oh, yeah.
Did you have, like, a set?
I never had Rock'em Sock'em Robots, but all my friends did. So we would all go play Rock'em Sock'em Robots. I remember there was a kid in my one of my elementary school classes who had Rock'em Sock'em Robots and brought it to school one day, and we played it out in the woods beyond the school grounds. So we'd go out at recess, and we'd disappear into the woods, and we'd set up this kind of wooded boxing ring, and they were in the center, and they were guys. It was, I mean, it was just out of, I don't know, it was out of Guys and Dolls.
Yeah, I was going to say, rule number one, don't talk about Rock'em Sock'em Robots Club.
That's exactly it.
I love it. And I'm a huge fan of these games as well. It, really interestingly, something that I learned from the episode was why they're designed as robots. You know why they're designed as robots?
No, I have no idea. I need to listen to Ludology.
Yeah, I know. You should
why
take a look at this episode.
Why are they designed as robots?
So one of the reasons why is because a very famous lightweight champion died right when this game was in the middle of being designed. And so the designers were like, because originally they were not robots. They were people.
They were guys.
Right?
Yeah,
And they would fall over once you defeated them. Right? But then they were like, well, how can we make this less insensitive at the at the current political moment? And it was really interesting. So the guys were like, well, let's make them robots, and let's make it so they don't die when they are hit, but instead their heads pop up. So there you go. There's a little bit of a taste of this episode, what you're going to get into with these.
You know, I have often wondered why we play a lot of games. We're like everybody. We play a lot of games. But some games seem frustrating and complicated, and like the ratio of time that it takes to learn the game and the payoff of playing the game is out of whack, and you know, but other games, certainly some of the classics that have been around for many hundreds of years or thousands of years, you know, there's something lovely about chess or checkers, or you know, and every once in a while a new game will come along that seems to have captured that sense of simplicity, that sense of elegance, that sense of the ratio of learning to play the game to satisfaction from playing the game being just about right. And it's a little bit of a mystery to me.
It's true. And I think that's one reason why I would suggest this podcast so much is simply because not only do you get some fun historical takes, but you also get a feed that is full of games you probably haven't heard of before necessarily. And it's kind of almost doubles as a kind of cream of the crop suggestion process, right? Where these people give you a little bit of some of the best stuff that exists out there. And there's all sorts of, they do all sorts of stuff from suggesting games to showing you, like, oh, I don't know, the most advanced AI system that plays Go. Or, you know, they talk about the, like, edible board game genre, which is, like, a super weird thing out there.
Suddenly I'm interested, I know, huh? I gotta tell you.
So you'll find a variety of things on there, but definitely there'll be something there for you.
So certainly, you know, some history behind some of these games, mm-hmm. in addition to sort of a primer on games that you may not be familiar with. So,
yeah.
So you're getting an insight into some of the classics, plus you're having, you know, you're having your game cupboard filled with suggestions by yeah. these guys, right?
Yeah. And in fact, like, another episode I would just suggest right off the top of my head, there's an episode all about parenting in board games and how board games can help you with your parenting or even therapy.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyways, cool stuff.
Wow. And we learned a new word today. If you didn't know the word ludology, which, as you say, is the study of play,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the name of this podcast. Find it wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And Stuart Foster, it's always a pleasure to have you introduce us to a new podcast.
Of course. Happy to be here and do it.
Our podcast cup runneth over. Great stories come into our lives in so many ways. Always a pleasure to chat with our old friend Stuart Foster about a podcast, that one called Ludology, the study of games. Going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with a story from Bill Harley. You won't want to miss it. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. Coming up now, we've got a story from Bill Harley, the wonderful songwriter, storyteller, and author. In this tale, Bill tells of a small town that just can't seem to pick a name for itself. After several rounds of trial and error, will they finally be able to come to a decision? Here's how the town around the bend got its name from Bill Harley.
I thought you might like to know a little bit about the town in which I live. It is a town which looks like a lot of other towns, and if you were just riding through it on a bicycle or rowing through it on a rowboat, you would never realize how different it is from other towns. My town is around the bend. Now, I'm not telling you where it is, I'm telling you the name of the town. The town is called Around the Bend. That's not what it used to be called. My town has had very many different names, some which you would like and some which you wouldn't. Once, it was called Ice Cream Sunday. Once it was called Green Beanburg. Once, for a long time, it was called Potato Town. Now, though, everybody calls it Around the Bend, which is probably better and simpler. But just why is an interesting story, which I am about to tell you. When people first started living in my town, it wasn't a town at all. It was just a place where a bunch of people lived. Nobody thought about naming themselves anything. They were just happy to be there. But after a while, it began to be a problem, because someone would ask you where you were from, and you would say, "Oh, I live somewhere between Diddleyville and Hog Hollow," and people would nod, but they wouldn't know exactly where. Everybody agreed that something had to be done, so one night, they all got together for a meeting at someone's house. They were going to have a potluck supper. Of course, that means that everybody brings one dish of food and you all share. Usually it works out pretty well. Somebody brings an appetizer, somebody brings a salad, and somebody brings a main dish, and a couple of people bring a dessert. But that day, nobody talked to anybody else about what they were bringing, and the funniest thing happened. Everybody brought pickles. All kinds of pickles, of course, sweet pickles and sour pickles and sweet and sour pickles, but all pickles. This was kind of funny because pickles are made of cucumbers, and cucumbers don't grow very well here. Mushrooms grow very well here, and so do strawberries, and so do long strings of licorice, but not cucumbers, and therefore not pickles. Everybody laughed when they saw that the dinner was all pickles, but everybody liked pickles a lot, and they sat down to a dinner of pickles. And they had a great time, and they laughed, and they talked, and they tried to think of a name for their new town. Maybe eating too many pickles is a bad idea, and maybe eating too many pickles makes you silly, because after a long time, somebody said, "Well, since we all like pickles so much, why don't we call our town Pickleopolis?" And those people were silly enough to think that was a good idea. And they called their town Pickleopolis. And they were so proud of the name, they all kept eating pickles. and word spread about the town, and people were coming from all over to eat pickles in Pickleopolis. That was all well and good for the people who were visiting Pickleopolis, because they would stop by on a hot Sunday afternoon and have a cold dish of butter pickles and be on their way. But after a year or two of eating pickles, the people who lived in Pickleopolis got plain sick of eating pickles and serving pickles and having strangers stop and ask if there was a good place to get a cold pickle. So they all got together for another dinner to talk about it. And this time, wouldn't you know it, everybody brought green beans. And after 2 years of pickles, those green beans tasted like the best thing that had ever happened to them. You can guess what happened. When they left that night, they had changed the name of the town to Green Beanburg. And for 6 or 7 months, things went pretty well. Green bean casserole, green bean souffle, green bean pizza. Then it happened again. They had enough. They got together for a big potluck, and everyone brought sausage. So everyone lived in Sausage City for a little while. I guess from a distance, that all looks pretty interesting. I guess it worked well enough. If you lived in our town long enough, you would get a balanced meal with all the major food groups. But problems arose. For one, sometimes people realized the name of the town was a mistake almost as soon as they chose it. Once, the grown-ups had the bad sense to all bring Brussels sprouts. Word got out the next morning when all the kids in town were served Brussels sprout pancakes. The kids were not happy. By the time lunch rolled around, half of the kids at the school had refused to eat. And the mayor of the town realized he was going to lose his job if he didn't suggest some other food. As it turned out, maybe it was good that the town was called Brussels Sproutville, if only for an hour or so, because the mayor immediately tried to find something that would calm down the students in the school and suggested macaroni and cheese. Our town was known as the village of macaroni and cheese for 6 years. 6 years of macaroni and cheese for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. For snacks and desserts, macaroni and cheese ice cream, macaroni and cheese cake, macaroni and cheese shakes. People in other towns were shaking their heads at us. They got tired of trying to explain how to get to our town. Someone would stop in the village of Dirtville and ask somebody how to get to Cotton Candy. And then the person would have to say, cotton candy didn't exist anymore. Now it was a town of strawberry rhubarb pie. So, after a while, people in neighboring towns would say, ah, that town is around the bend. Around the bend means it's just around the corner, but it also means that someone is a little bit crazy, wacky as a two-nosed clown. If someone put ketchup on their chocolate ice cream, you would say, that person's around the bend. Or if a girl wore her underwear outside of her party dress, you would say, that girl is around the bend. Now, people still talk about if the people in the other towns mean that our town was close by or if it was just a little bit crazy. But after a while, most people just started calling us around the bend. And to tell you the truth, we were a little bit relieved because we were getting tired of eating the same thing all the time, even if the same thing kept changing. So, a couple of years ago, we all got together for a potluck. But this time, the kindergarten teacher called everybody and told them what to bring, and there were all different kinds of foods, and everybody had a good time. And at the end of the meal, we all agreed to change our town officially to the town around the bend. And that's what we are today. And now, we eat just about anything we want, anytime we want. And things work out pretty well, though of course, still, even today, not many kids will eat Brussels sprouts. And where is our town? Well, really, I guess it's just what it says, around the bend.
Bill Harley with how the town around the bend got its name. Up next, a story from Liz Weir, who's been telling stories way back since the 1970s, when she discovered her passion for the healing power that comes from telling stories. This is from a collection called Boom Chicka Boom, and it's called Master of All Masters. Liz Weir on the Appleseed.
Long ago in England, there was a young girl whose family needed her to go out for work. And so she went to the marketplace. And as was the custom, she went to the place where all the young people stood and waited for someone to hire them. She waited a number of hours and thought she might never get some work. Until suddenly, a rather strange elder gentleman walked up to her, and he peered deeply into her eyes.
"Are you looking for work?"
And she nodded quietly.
"Then come with me," he said.
And so she followed him down the street, around the corner, and up the next street they stopped in front of a beautiful home. It had a black wrought iron fence around it, rose bushes on either side of the door. He brought her inside, and he turned to her and he said,
"You shall be my maid. But before you get started, let's get a few things straight. What will you call me?"
"Master or mister, or whatever you please, sir."
"Wrong. You shall call me Master of All Masters. And what do you call these?"
He pointed to his pants. "Pants or trousers or whatever you please, sir."
"You shall call these squibs and crackers. And what do you call that?"
He was pointing to his bed. "Bed or cot or whatever you please, sir."
"You shall call that a barnacle. And what do you call that?"
He pointed to a bucket of water. "Water or wet or whatever you please, sir."
"Wrong. That is condolorum. And what do you call this?"
He pointed to the fire. "Fire or flame or whatever you please, sir."
"You shall call that hot cocolorum. And what do you call her?"
He pointed to his cat. "Cat or kit, whatever you please, sir."
"You shall call her white-faced simony. And what of all this place? What do you call this?"
He meant his house. "House or cottage, or whatever you please, sir."
"You shall call this high top a mountain. Now, go about your work and do not forget."
And so the girl went to the kitchen, and she polished the silver and washed the dishes and got the linens ready for the next day. And then it was time to retire for the night. In the middle of the night, there was a knocking on his door. "Master of all masters, get out of your barnacle, put on your squibs and crackers. White-faced simony has a spot of hot cocolorum on its tail, and if you don't pour a bucket of condolorum on white-faced simony soon, high top a mountain will all be on hot cocolorum."
Liz Weir with a story called Master of All Masters. One more tale for you today, this one from Dolores Hydock. It's called No New Story. Dolores grew up in Pennsylvania, lives in Alabama now. And in this story, you'll get a sneak peek into the exciting life that she lives and the way she tries to come up with her stories. Not always as easy as you might think. Here's Dolores Hydock with No New Story on the Appleseed.
One of the things that I'm always hoping will happen, one of the things that I'm always hoping is a possibility for me, is the possibility of a new story. I'm always looking for a new story. And back in mid-January, I really, really, really wanted to have a new story. There was a story workshop I was going to on a Sunday afternoon, and there in mid-January, and I really wanted to have a new story for that workshop. I'd been working on one for weeks, but everything I came up with was trite, stupid, boring. It wasn't even interesting to me. It got to be the Friday night before the Sunday afternoon workshop. I had one more day. On Saturday, a new story had to come together. Saturday starts out raining. A thunderstorm, in fact, thunder and lightning outside my window on a Saturday morning in mid-January. Well, because of the rain, I can't take my morning walk as I usually do, and so I just have a leisurely breakfast, a couple of cups of coffee. I settle in with a library book, a book about recipes and stories about those recipes, and I think to myself, I have never once in my entire life cooked rhubarb. Or used a mortar and pestle, like some of the people in the stories do. And I'm sitting there thinking, have I ever had a mortar and pestle? Would I know where to get a mortar and pestle when I hear a meow at the back door? I'm being summoned by the cat, the neighborhood cat who employs all of us humans within a two-block square as his personal maintenance staff. So I scrape some fancy feast into a bowl, head out the back door, but I have misinterpreted the meow. The cat does not want a feast. The cat wants to come inside. He tries to scoot past me into the kitchen out of the rain, but I stop him. I grab my jacket, put the feast down, go outside to sit with him on the chair next to the back door, protected from the rain by the roof over the back porch. The cat doesn't jump into my lap right away the way he usually does. He just sits there looking at me. Bright green eyes gleaming in the still dark January morning. It occurs to me that my lap is 3 feet off the ground, and he appears to be debating whether it might be smarter to stay 3 feet further away from the lightning. I watch him debate, crouch, his muscles tense, then a clap of thunder sends him scooting off to take shelter under the car in the driveway. I go back inside, have another cup of coffee, finish the library book about recipe stories. It's a Saturday, so there's lots of chores. Laundry, 18 houseplants that need to be watered. So I get started on those projects. I make my lists of things I need to do, people I need to get in touch with, stuff I need from the store. And then I realize the rain has stopped. Sun's come out. Oh, it looks like it's going to be a beautiful morning. I can take my walk after all. So I lace on my sneakers, grab my jacket, but before I get out the back door, the phone rings. It's my friend Julie, who lives in Germany, calling to catch up. We haven't talked in a couple of months, so we're on the phone, I don't know, an hour, more or less, probably more. She tells me about her grandbabies, twin boys, 16 months old, who are the most charming, the most adorable, the most intelligent babies on this planet, or any planet. Tells me about her plans for her spring garden, about her husband's upcoming retirement, about her son moving to Boston. While we talk, thanks to a headset that I have on my wireless phone, I finish folding the laundry, dust the living room furniture, mop the kitchen floor, peel and section 3 grapefruits so that there are already easy, convenient, peeled grapefruit slices there in the refrigerator, because it is never easy or convenient to peel and section grapefruit when you want them on the spur of the moment, and that is why people never eat their grapefruit, but just let them grow fuzzy gray beards in the bottom of the crisper jar. Well, when I get off the phone with Julie, I remember that I have a book on reserve at the library, but they'll only hold it 3 days, and today is the last day I can go and pick it up. And so I think, well, I'll just make a quick trip down to the library, but then I remember, oh, if I'm going to the library, first I have to print out the recipe for those rose water muffins that I took down there a week ago, right after I discovered that I don't like the taste of rose water muffins at all. And so I took the muffins down to the librarians because they're the ones who save all the new cookbooks for me and are responsible for the rose water experiment in the first place. And so a week ago, I took the muffins down there, and then 3 days after that, when I stopped by for something else, one of the librarians told me that they discovered they don't like rose water either. But there were two little boys in the library the day that I brought the muffins by, Denby and Brent, and they wanted to try the muffins, and their mother said it was okay, and so they tried them, and Denby and Brent liked them. Denby and Brent rated them 50 on a scale of 5. And their mother said to the librarian, well, do you think that lady would share that recipe with me? And then 3 days later, when I came by, she told me that. And I said, of course, I will give her the recipe. I will also give her the rosewater extract and all the other weird spices that go in those muffins that I know I am never going to make again. And so now, this Saturday, before I can go to the library to pick up my reserved book, first I have to print out that rosewater muffin recipe. And as the printer is finishing, I hear someone at the back door, and a voice says, it's only me, I brought you some slaw. It's my friend and companion of more than 26 years, who has just gone to have lunch at his favorite barbecue restaurant, which is 16 miles away from his house, and he has to pass 9 other barbecue restaurants to get to it. But it is not only his favorite barbecue restaurant, it is his favorite restaurant in all the world. In fact, if he were about to be executed and they offered him one last meal, the chopped pork plate from Ken's in Pinson is what he would ask for. Well, I like their slaw, and he knows that, and he is a very good fella of more than 26 years. And so whenever he goes there for lunch, he brings me back a little container of their fresh, sweet slaw. And that is what he has just done. And now he is dropping the slaw off at my house before he goes to his house, because he knows if that slaw ever makes it all the way to his house, he will never remember to bring it over to my house. And that slaw will just languish there in his refrigerator until it becomes the color and texture of something in a petri dish at the Centers for Disease Control. And so there he is at the back door saying, it's only me, I brought you some slaw. And so I go to greet him, and I see that it is a gorgeous day outside. And I say, wow, what a beautiful day it's turned out to be. If you have a couple of minutes, let's go sit outside and talk for a second. So we go up to the turquoise chairs that are in the sun, this January golden sun that is somehow making it 70 degrees outside. And we sit there and we chat a while, and then he says, you want to go see those trees with me? And I say, yes, what a great idea, because it is a great idea. There is a new planting of 9 Japanese maples at the Japanese garden section of the Botanical Gardens. And my fella grafted and grew and donated 6 of those 9 trees. And now he wants to see how they look with all the mulch and everything in place. And there were other things I was going to do that Saturday afternoon. I was going to write a new story, for instance, but it is a sunny 70-degree January Saturday. And how many sunny 70-degree January Saturdays do you get in life? And here is this charming man saying to me, not only, you want to come see some trees that I grew, but he's saying to me, you want to come spend some time with me? And even though we have been lucky enough to already have had 26 years of Saturdays together, and might be lucky enough to have 26 more years of Saturdays together, is it enough? Is it ever enough? Or will there come some day when I will say, oh, if we could just have one more Saturday together? But I don't want to go there. I don't want to spiral down that rabbit hole. I already feel bad enough about stupid things I've actually done. I don't want to waste time regretting things I haven't even made mistakes yet. So I just decide I will seize the carpe diem spirit of the moment and recognize a gift horse when it pulls into my driveway. So we climb into his truck and head over to the botanical garden, stopping first at the library so I can drop off that muffin recipe, hoping that if that mother ever makes those muffins, Denby and Brent will still like them, though I doubt it. I suspect the novelty will have worn off and that poor mother will be stuck with a dozen muffins that taste like somebody's grandmother's perfume. Well, we get to the botanical gardens on this sunny 70-degree January Saturday. The gardens are full of sunshine, full of people, families, babies, couples. There is a teenage girl wearing black short shorts and black high-top sneakers and a white off-one-shoulder blouse. She is walking hand in hand with a teenage boy who you can see is trying really hard to focus on what she is telling him about, like, my mom, and how, like, my mom said to me, how could you do that? And I said, like, mom, like, how could you not think I would do it? And you can see he is working really hard to concentrate on her words. But there is the pale, soft skin of that one bare shoulder out in the sunshine for the first time that year, and it is clear he is not hearing one word she said. My fella and I wander over to the Japanese garden. There are his trees. They're little now, but one day The reflection of their red, gold, green leaves will shimmer in the koi pond under the zigzag bridge. The best time to plant a tree, my fella tells me, is 20 years ago. We stroll through the camellia garden, big, fat, pink camellia blossoms weighing down the branches. And then we head back, go back the long way. Go home through neighborhoods that are full of memories for us, and those memories are full of stories, stories that insist we pull off on the side of the road and tell those stories to each other for the 100th time. By the time we get back to my house, the cat is ready for the feast he did not want at 7 o'clock in the morning, but he wants it now. And then I see that there is a little tin container of oatmeal cookies on my back porch table. I know who they're from. There's only one friend who makes those cookies and is kind enough to share them with me. And so my fella goes back to his house, and I go inside and call my friend and thank her for the cookies, and we chat for a while. And then I make a sandwich to eat with my slaw and have an oatmeal cookie for dessert. And then because it is mid-January, it is getting dark outside and the day is almost over. And that is why at the story workshop the very next afternoon, the only new story I had to tell was this one.
No new story, a story told for you by Dolores Hydock. It's from a collection called It Could Happen, Stories of Hope and Possibility. A pleasure to bring you that tale, as well as stories from Liz Weir and Bill Harley and Bob Reiser. A pleasure to share with you a conversation with Stuart Foster and an entry in the Radio Family Journal. Find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed. Send us an email at theappleseed@byu.edu or Google the Appleseed Podcast for something new just about every day on the show. This hour was written by Lacey Ivey. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer is Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne. Can't wait to be with you again on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by the Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.